This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
We take a look at one of the most prolific Mexican artists, Frida Kahlo, through the lens of our friends at En Confianza with Pulso Podcast. Frida Kahlo's painted self-portraits have gained widespread recognition around the world. Younger generations continue to proudly lift up Frida as a symbol of unapologetic feminism and artistic freedom. And while Frida Kahlo's art has been widely popularized and even commercialized, it still represents bold self-determination and strength in the face of crushing patriarchy. Up next, we hear from producer Anthony Wallace about the story of Tanya Betancourt Alcazar, a member of the art group The Phoenix Fridas, who discovered a lifeline in the art of Frida Kahlo. By embracing Frida's artistic message of resilience and empowerment, Tanya would later find the inner strength to confront her own traumas and transform her pain into art.
Tanya Betancourt Alcazar made a big choice in her mid-20s.
I decided to be child-free by choice because I think that's my authenticity, like me saying, hey, I love children, but they're not for me.
In her world, this was a radical decision, and she was afraid to tell anyone about it.
All the women in my family have had children, so I'm kind of making my own path.
And in 2019, she was on a trip to LA with a new group of friends. They were in their hotel room crafting and painting together the night before ConchaCon, an art festival dedicated to the brightly colored Mexican pastries. And there she decided it was time to get the child-free thing off her chest.
And they were the first women that I shared with that I wanted to be child-free, when I hadn't even shared that with my family. And I'm sorry, I'm getting choked up, but just to hear them, like, listen to my decision, and then for them to, like, be mothers and following a different path than I was, but still saying, hey, I support you and I back you, and they're not trying to change my mind, that meant the world to me.
That moment of deep empathy, of rebellion against cultural norms, it reflects the person that brought them all together. Her friends at the hotel that night were her fellow Phoenix Fridas, a Latina art collective dedicated to and named after the great Mexican artist Frida Kahlo. Most people, if they know Frida Kahlo at all, only know her face. But Tanya and her fellow Phoenix Fridas have considered her life and art much more deeply, and it's had a profound effect on them. Tanya was born in Mexico, moved to the U.S. as a small child, and when she started school, she didn't know English. She was timid, shy, and afraid to rock the boat.
That's something maybe I wanted to be more like, is like express myself more. As a kid, I felt like I couldn't express myself the way I wanted to. And I love that Frida Kahlo would do that. She would express herself and she didn't really care what people thought of her.
Frida Kahlo was courageous, defiant, bluntly honest, a fierce defender of the underdog and a powerful political activist. Behind Frida's famous unibrow is an inspiring, historic, and provocative story with the power to change lives.
Frida's work inspired me to be unapologetic, to be, honestly, a disruptor. Frida did whatever she wanted to, not as long as it made her happy, but as long as she was true to herself.
As a teenager, Frida Kahlo was physically impaled by a steel beam and broke her spine in a bus accident, and her body never really healed. She was in constant pain and constant need of surgery. She needed more than 30 over the course of her life. But she never stopped living, dancing, painting, and pushing boundaries, sometimes in bed with a cane or in a full torso cast. She wore a men's suit in a formal family photo in the 1920s. And she was shamelessly bisexual before that term was really a thing. She studied biology, philosophy, and history at the top prep school in Mexico, where she was one of only a few dozen girls in a student body of 2,000. She found her own way into the upper echelons of the Mexican Communist Party, where she got to know her husband, the legendary painter Diego Rivera. Together, they housed the Marxist revolutionary Leon Trotsky, as Stalinist agents threatened to scale their walls to murder him. Diego's lucrative murals led them to the United States, where they dined and drank with the Rockefellers and Fords, and used their power to subvert them. Diego painted Karl Marx at Rockefeller Center, and Frida mocked the Nazi-sympathizing Henry Ford to his face at a crowded dinner table. Two of the people Frida loved the most, Diego and her younger sister Christina, had an extended affair. She was broken physically, betrayed cruelly, and belittled by the press and the art world, not taken seriously as a painter in her own right. But she took all of her persistence, intellect, eye for beauty, and bloody pain, and infused it into her art. Her paintings are attention-grabbing, sometimes shocking, but always deeply thought-provoking. Tania found Frida when she was a shy kid who felt she didn't belong. Now she's a multimedia artist and communications coordinator for a nonprofit that is working to give power to marginalized communities. She's colorfully, passionately, and courageously fighting for what she believes in, just like Frida did. For Tania and many others like her, Frida Kahlo is a source of not only inspiration, but power. From Frida Kahlo and the Phoenix Fridas, Tania found the courage to be authentic. But what she didn't know, crafting in that hotel room in LA with her newest and closest confidants, is that tragedy would soon strike the Fridas, and she would need all of the resilience and courage she could muster to get through it. Today, Frida is everywhere. On thousands and thousands of products, t-shirts, tote bags, there's even a Frida Kahlo emoji set and a strangely light-skinned Frida Kahlo Barbie doll.
Frida Kahlo. Her work and her story inspires me every day.
But despite the fact that Frida's been dead for nearly 70 years, her mega fame is a relatively recent phenomenon.
I first encountered her in an art history classroom in the 1980s. And that time, she was not well known at all in the United States. And I thought, this is one powerful, powerful woman.
This is Celia Starr, an art historian at the University of San Francisco and the author of Frida in America, The Creative Awakening of a Great Artist. Frida died in the 1950s, and for a while after her death, she was pretty obscure. Then, in the early 80s, a major biography about her hit the shelves and she started to pop up in mainstream culture. During her life, Frida sold paintings for less than $200. In the 70s, you could buy one for $40,000. By 1990, they were going for well over $1 million.
I'm starting to see in the 90s, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And I really thought we had reached a point of saturation.
The Frida face t-shirts multiplied. People talked about Frida mania. But when it seemed like she couldn't get any bigger, she did.
Behind the madness lies the mystery of one of the most seductive and most intriguing women of ours or any time.
To Frida! To
Frida!
Frida.
And then, of course, we have the movie Frida come out based on the biography. And then Salma Hayek really brings her to another level of fame in the United States.
The movie made over $50 million at the box office and sent Frida mania into full swing. When it came out, Tania was 10 years old.
I didn't know much about Frida until the movie. My mom and I watched it, and it was like the first time we saw representation of our country, our culture, right? Like on the big screen.
At the time, Tania and her mom hadn't been in the U.S. for very long.
I was born in Mexico, in Chihuahua, Mexico, and then my mom first came out to the United States, and then I followed. So, I was 3 years old, so I'm very proud Mexican-American.
At first, they lived in San Francisco, where Tania's mom met who had become her stepdad. He was an immigrant himself from Guatemala. Together, they made a lively household.
Like my dad's side was more like merengue and cumbia. My mom's side was a little bit more rancheras and Selena. So it was two different worlds, but I am so glad that I grew up in that.
But of course, the transition to a new country was difficult, especially when Tanya started school.
I grew up knowing Spanish at home, speaking Spanish at home, and then having to switch to English in school was tough at first because I didn't know the language. I was definitely very shy as a kid. I moved schools often, so I was always the new kid. I dealt with bullying, you know, so I always relate with outcasts. I relate with them because I feel like I was an outcast. I found solace in like Harry Potter because he was an outcast as well. Very different, strange child.
Frida was also a strange child, often forced into isolation. When she was six, she got polio, which left her with one skinny leg and a lifelong limp. And when she was 18, the wooden bus she was riding home was shattered in a violent collision with a trolley car. Her spinal column, ribs, collarbone, pelvis, and right leg were broken. A steel handrail impaled her, piercing her abdomen, damaging her uterus, and exiting out her groin. Doctors expected her to die. But as she would do throughout her life, she defied expectations. From that point on, she spent weeks and months at a time alone, debilitated and confined to bed. She developed a deep affinity for the forgotten people, the poor, the Harry Potters, and the outcasts of the world. Here's Frida expert Celia Starr again.
Frida was somebody who was always for the underdog. You know, she was dealing with physical disabilities. And as a bisexual woman, she often was marginalized.
But the accident didn't just make Frida more empathetic. It ultimately energized her and made her the Frida Kahlo we know today. She got a special easel that was connected to her bed, and she started painting. Frida painted a self-portrait called The Broken Column. In it, her torso is split in half vertically, and a crumbling Roman column is in the place of her spine. Nails puncture her skin all over her body, and tears fall from her eyes. But her expression is stoic. Growing up, Tanya also found solace in honest artistic expression.
I would just like draw and doodle. And then also I like to document my life too, like diaries, which is also a form of being creative. I feel like I've been a multi-passionate creative all my life, sewing, photography, video. So yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Tanya's family moved to Phoenix. Her parents had two more kids, her little sisters, and she grew up. She started a YouTube channel with her husband and did some work as a photographer. She kept coming out of her shell and pushing the limits of her self-expression. But still, in her mid-20s, she felt like she was missing the close group of friends she never made in school.
I have a very traumatic history of having female friends in my life. You know, I went through bullying and things like that. So I think 2017 was the year that I really wanted to be surrounded by creative women, have like female friends more in my life.
And that's where Mo came in.
My husband's friend, who became my friend, Mo, her name Monique, she was working at Tres Leches Cafe. She hit up Jose and she was like, hey, I saw your channel and I wish you could like do a feature on our cafe.
We're checking out this Mexican gourmet cafe, which is located in Central Phoenix.
Yeah, so we're really excited. You guys are gonna love this place. It's awesome.
Yeah.
They went to visit and vlog at Tres Leches, and Tanya met Mo, who was a Phoenix Frida. At that point, the Fridas had been around for over a decade. They were a tight-knit group and highly respected in the Phoenix art scene. They didn't let new people in all the time, but Mo saw something in Tanya.
From that point on, we just started talking. Like, she saw my videos. Mo said that I should join the Phoenix Fridas, so they brought me on, and I have friends for life. Like, I was honestly so happy just to be a part of a creative group and that they recognized and saw that I was a creative woman in the community too. So I felt really honored by that.
The group put on joint art shows, threw an annual birthday party for Frida, did a pilgrimage to Frida's house in Mexico City, and talked a lot about Frida's work together. The conversations brought them all closer to each other and closer to Frida. and they made Tanya bolder and more confident.
I created one of her self-portraits where she chopped off all her hair. And my rebellion was that I dyed my hair blue because my mom would always be like, oh, those are like crazy colors, you know? So for me, that was my rebellion.
One of the best new friends she made in the group was Luisa Leon, who was just a few years older than her.
You know, Luisa, she had very colorful hair. Like, I related with her in that. And she was very colorful, just like her paintings.
Luisa was there when Tanya told the group about her plans to be child-free.
She would tell me, she's like, I feel like you're a mom already. You are a nurturer. So she saw things in me that I didn't see.
Luisa, Mo, and the rest of the Phoenix Fridas quickly became Tanya's friends, confidants, and motivators. As they pushed her to become herself and be fearless creatively, she developed a pretty radical approach to social media, especially with her autobiographical Second A Day videos.
I started to not only turn the camera toward me, but also turn the camera toward myself when I wasn't at my highest point of feeling the best I could be. And that is very similar to Frida. She documented a lot of her pain, her suffering. A lot of my 1 seconds do have that. Like, they show when I'm crying or show when I've been distressed. Social media in a way is a form of art, right? Expression of like what is going on in your life. So I think when I started being really raw and honest and documenting my life, at least on social media, I would get people in the DMs and be like, I completely feel the way you do.
In her 1 second videos, she cries, dances, goes to concerts and does Zoom meetings. She sews, lays in bed, makes coffee, and hangs with her family. Recently, she's been kicking pads and playing games in karate class, alongside a bunch of elementary school kids. In one post, she opens up about being child-free by choice, and another about her insecurity about being a light-skinned Latina. Her honesty is attention-grabbing. The posts start conversations about taboo things people would normally keep inside.
How did it like feel to be having these conversations?
I definitely felt I wasn't alone anymore. I didn't feel as isolated as I felt, especially like in the height of the pandemic, going through, you know, depression, going through just so many things, losing people in my life. I think I didn't feel as alone.
When the pandemic shut things down in 2020, the Phoenix Fridas did what they could to continue bringing color and life into the world, even remotely. Tanya did a special quarantine photo series, and her friend Luisa did Instagram live painting lessons for 100 consecutive nights. And it even got some news coverage.
She started painting lives with Luisa mid-March and has quickly gained momentum.
It started with having about 5 people watching me until now, which is over 100 people every night tuning in. This experience for me has just reinstated what I always wanted to know, which was my purpose in life. And I think my purpose is to get other people to just create for themselves and just have fun doing it.
But on top of the same isolation and fear of the virus that we all felt, Tanya was forced to stare at all of 2020's horrible news all day long. She was a layout designer for a major newspaper company, and it was taking a toll on her mental health. And making things worse, her employer restricted her from responding to the news with her usual passion and honesty.
When George Floyd happened, Black Lives Matter demonstrations happened, you couldn't go and like hold a sign or nothing like that. That would be like under violation. So I was like fed up. I felt, you know, like I couldn't express myself the way I wanted to.
So she turned to her fellow Fridas, Luisa specifically.
I was like telling her that I hate my job. She's like, let's get you a better job. She really pushed me.
With Luisa motivating her, Tanya got serious about finding a new job. But about a year into the pandemic, tragedy hit the Fridas. Mo was just 42 years old, but Tanya said she had psoriasis and it took a bad turn during quarantine.
It was February 2021. Mo had been struggling with her health. And her organs weren't working on by themselves anymore. So she unfortunately passed away. She was very young, you know, still. You know, I went to her funeral, and some of the Fridas went, some of us, you know, we're still very in the deep of the pandemic, so it was hard, right?
Just a couple months later, Luisa, who was just 33, came down with COVID.
In July, we got the news that she had gotten COVID, and then, you know, we prayed for her. We thought she was going to be out of it, you know, just given her age. Then following month, she was gone.
Luisa Leon died in August of COVID-19, and she inspired many people during this pandemic as she taught hundreds of people how to paint online. And she did this for 100 days straight during quarantine, reaching people all over the world.
It's just very, very sudden. And it was very hard for all of us. You know, I still remember us being like in a room and just crying. It's just, she really motivated me. She was very unapologetic. Something I always admired about her. She always would see the bright side in things. She just found a way to like bring light into darkness. And I really miss her. She meant a lot to me.
With Luisa's encouragement and help, Tanya did get that new job.
She was always like motivating me. And I never got to tell her that I got a new job. I never got to tell her. And I know she's with me. Like, I'm even looking at that sticker on my water bottle, and she had blue hair, you know. And I know she shows up for me. Whenever I want to feel bold or unapologetic, I always try to channel her. I really miss her. I really miss both her and Mo.
2021 for Tanya was a seemingly relentless barrage of emotional pain.
I think two things got me through difficult times. One was family and friends. And then two, I think I really found solace in my sewing machine. I would sew a lot. I would make things for friends, and I would just sit there and listen to podcasts or listen to music, and I would just make things, you know.
And always by her sewing machine is a little picture of Frida Kahlo.
Yeah, that postcard I got in Ciudad de Mexico, and I always have her there as like inspiration.
And she found purpose in the new job that Luisa inspired her to get.
I am a marketing and communications coordinator. I work for an organization called Instituto. It's based here in Arizona. It's an organization that helps build political infrastructure with low income and communities of color here in the state.
During these last midterm elections, she even knocked on doors and helped get a bill passed that allows DACA recipients who live in Arizona to get in-state tuition rates for college. And this political work, Tanya also sees as following in Frida's footsteps.
She was fighting for the working class. And then also, like, her sexuality, too. Like, she was very outspoken about that as well.
Yes, she was, you know, she was a very political person. She was interested in communism early on before she meets Diego Rivera. Oftentimes, you know, people say, oh, it's because of Diego that she got interested in communism. Not true. I mean, she called herself a child of the revolution.
Frida sometimes shifted her birth year from 1907 to 1910, the year of the peasant-led Mexican Revolution. Together, Diego and Frida helped create a new Mexican culture and national identity, magnifying the poor, indigenous, and working people of Mexico.
By the time she gets to the United States, and it's 1933, she's seen a lot. you know, she has seen the people who can't afford to eat lined up on streets and waiting, you know, to just get some soup. But then at the same time, she's hobnobbing with, you know, the Rockefellers. And there you have, you know, the exact opposite.
She wanted authenticity, raw beauty, to stick up for the outcast and to expose hypocrisy. Frida loved MoMA and the jazz clubs in Harlem. Her paintings showed black protesters in New York and dystopian smokestack landscapes in Detroit. At one dinner party hosted by the mogul Henry Ford, an anti-Semite who Hitler praised in Mein Kampf, Frida played dumb. At a lull in the conversation, she asked, "Mr. Ford, are you Jewish?" There was an awkward silence and then an uproar of laughter.
She was incredibly bold for her time period, but she's still bold today. I mean, that's what's amazing, right? Is that the unibrow, for example, is still bold.
After they lost Mo and Louisa, the Phoenix Fridas retired the group after 18 years.
Having the passing of our members too felt like a chapter closing. Like, it kind of felt odd to continue without them. And I think the group had accomplished its purpose of bringing joy and love of Frida into Phoenix.
Frida Kahlo and the Phoenix Fridas made their mark and changed their world. Tanya was once timid and bullied. Now she's courageously and creatively asserting herself, saying what others are afraid to. And while she was once new to the U.S., unable to speak English, she's now a political force, making her mark on the country. And as she's evolved, she's become more like her hero she first saw on a Hollywood movie. And the ripples of Frida mania are still flowing out everywhere. Yes, there is something ironic about Frida as a brand, given her feelings about capitalism. But even when you only see that unibrow out of context, it leaves an impression. Every Frida bag, every Frida drink or pair of socks, it's just another chance for someone to pause and wonder, who is that person really?
Frida is a gateway to Mexican culture. And she's not just a flower crown. She was political. Everything about her struggles was like intersectional, right? Her disability, her politics, her sexuality. You have to take all parts of her, not just cherry pick. And I think she creates conversation to this day. And that's what I really love about her, is that she's still stirring up drama, you know, she's still stirring up controversy. And I think that's her.
When she was 47, Frida's always tenuous health took a turn for the worse, and she came down with a bad case of pneumonia. Still in July of 1954, she summoned what little life she had left and took to the streets of Mexico City by wheelchair to protest the CIA's intervention in Guatemala. Less than 2 weeks later, her funeral procession went down the same city streets. As Frida's body was pushed into the crematorium, a strange thermodynamic phenomenon took place. The dead artist suddenly sprung into an upright position, her hair on fire and her mouth apparently smiling. Even her dead body defied limitations as it arose and glowed with an infectious energy. And her power and influence continues to grow, making new generations of determined, bold fighters for life and defiers of limitation. The year before she died, she had to have her leg amputated. In her diary, she wrote, "Feet, what do I need them for if I have wings to fly?"
DJ Namde from Radio Aphrodisia. Join us every Saturday as we nice up your weekend. It's all about music from Africa and the African world. Radio Aphrodisia, 4 to 6 p.m. It's Champeta Criolla from the coast of Caribbean, Soca Calypso, Juju Music, Musica Afro-Cubana, Cha-Cha-Cha, Afrobeat Highlife. It's all in the mix. Radio Aphrodisia, Saturdays, 4 to 6 p.m. Showtime. Tune in! Yeah, you're totally just true.
election season at KPFK. Starting June 1st, you will have the opportunity to get involved by running as a listener candidate or registering to nominate candidates who will represent you on KPFK's local station board. Be sure to renew your membership by June 30th in order to participate. Visit elections.pacifica.org for more information.
Support comes from the Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, presenting renowned singer, songwriter, agent of social change, and political artist Holly Neer, Thursday, June 13, 2024, at 7:30 p.m. Holly Neer has had an amazing, exemplary life of artistry, performance, songwriting, and activism. Holly's songs and anthems continue to lift our spirits as we work together for women's rights, social justice, and peace. The Theatricum Botanicum is located at 1419 North Topanga Canyon Boulevard in Topanga. For more information and tickets, visit theatricum.com and kpfk.org.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
Today, my guest, Lola Mondragon of Ventura, California, answers the questions, who and what should be remembered and memorialized on this national day of glorifying militarism and wars? Listen first to Lola Mondragon, Choctaw Chicana and U.S. Navy veteran.
Welcome to Women's Magazine, Lola Mondragon. Thank you so much for being here, soon to be Dr. Mondragon. As an academic of color, I'm very, very proud. I'm sure your ties to the academy, whatever they have been complicated. Nonetheless, I want to publicly congratulate you on this achievement. Thank you so much for being on my program today.
I am honored and filled with joy because I get to hear people in my community, including yourself, remind me of the accomplishment that something like getting your doctorate can be, despite the experiences that we as women of color have in those spaces. And so my teachers, most definitely, or my grandmothers and my mother and my daughters and granddaughters. Pleased that I'm able to be here with you and share in the ways that Memorial Day tends to forget or ignore other things that need to be memorialized.
Yes, so thank you for being on the program. The whole focus of the show today is discussing the question, who and what else needs to be remembered? Who and what else needs to be memorialized on this Memorial Day for the various ways in which they sacrificed, gave, not necessarily for the, quote, good of the nation or as part of the imperial project of the U.S. military?
Well, I will share with you that I served in the Navy from 95 to 98 and then was military dependent for 21 years until my husband retired. He has now been designated 100% disabled veteran. The work that I do really is bringing some accountability and visibility to those communities, especially Native American and Indigenous veteran women who are often the recipients of a lot of that militarization and violence. Recently, within the last decade or so, we've been really highlighting issues around missing and murdered Indigenous women, but we haven't paid attention so much to the missing and murdered Indigenous soldiers, including women and Two-Spirit, you know, queer people in the military. I recently wrote a piece for the Harvard Chronicle talking about missing and murdered Indigenous soldiers and the rematriation that came from it, so as not to forget that they are still contributing to our knowledge systems. They gave so much, and unfortunately, our society does not really pay attention to that. You know, we might have issues around women that are still alive, that served in the military, that suffered from military sexual trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injuries, and all those things that come around with that, including them coming home having high percentages of suicide. amongst those populations. Now, we couple that with the high suicide rates in Native communities, and I don't know if the research is out there, but that is something that I'm wanting to investigate to see how that and if that does happen at higher rates amongst Native women. If I was to begin this conversation, I think I would say that to me, one of the most important women that allowed me to begin this journey, it was an Army specialist named Lavina Johnson, who was a Black female Army soldier who ended up getting murdered in a contractor's tent. And the military ruled her death a suicide. But her father, who was a doctor, asked for her medical records, and in there found all the different ways in which her body had been mutilated and abused. His wanting to know and investigate and seek justice for her really spoke to my own experience in the military, because I found myself to be one of the lucky ones that got out alive. And I felt like she had been one of the ones that didn't get out alive. And I think the same thing about another soldier who was in the Army as well, named Vanessa Guillen, murdered, violently murdered, dismembered, and burned down at Fort Hood in Texas. Again, another reminder, she was kind of the impetus to like the Me Too movement within the military. I felt a close connection with her also because for a lot of reasons, once her parents were immigrants, my father was an immigrant, her father's name is Rogelio, like my dad is Rogelio. She had joined the military to go in to be able to get the GI Bill to go study chemical engineering. Before I joined the military, I was majoring in chemical engineering. So there was all these little things that I was just like, oh my goodness. You know, there's so many. And then her sisters just did not give up, and they demanded accountability from the military. They brought in the media and attorneys and all this. And I know, knowing my sisters, they would have done the same for me. To me, that is the population that often does not get any attention, is those, you know, BIPOC populations in the military that get murdered from within. They're either, you know, mislabeled as suicide or just an accident. Going through all the research that I did for over a decade, I found that a lot of the women that I had looked up and investigated, there was a mystery to their deaths, you know. It was a story, I think it was just in a newspaper that I was able to read, and this woman left her boots on the side of the ship, and she apparently dove into the ocean off of a Navy carrier. I was on a combat ship with 1,500 Marines. I can tell you that there's a lot of ways in which people can disappear off ships. So I don't buy those kind of, you know, just happenstance or ambiguities. We have to be real and truthful about the racism and sexism and homophobia that exists in the military and the people that are actively hunting these communities within the military. Those are not necessarily the ones that are memorialized, and they're just mourned by their communities without any real answers of what happened to their sons and daughters or mothers or sisters. I think that we really do need to speak about it and remember them.
Well, this is why I'm really so happy you're on this program talking with us today. You said earlier that these soldiers, even though they're not recognized, carry a lot of knowledge with them. They're knowledge keepers. And with them goes some of the knowledge. What is the wisdom that the soldiers you've been working with bring to how we understand the world, how we understand our communities as people of color, women of color?
So I'm currently finishing up my interviews. I'll speak of the last one, her experience in combat and being overseas in Iraq, and how she had gone not to take lives, but to save lives when she was going over there. She's Ottawa, out of Michigan, Anishinaabe. She had been doing ceremonies since she was very young, part of the Native American church. When she got over there, these towns just got overrun by the military. They had swimming pools, movie theaters, they had all this, but the people weren't there anymore. So she would sit there and wonder, what happened to all the people that lived here? State, she says, this is what they did to our people. I'm participating in a project. I'm wearing this uniform of coming to another country to be a colonizer in these other places. And she said, I didn't know it when I was young, but it was later when I went to school and I found out what colonizing means, you know. But she knew internally in her bones that there was something wrong with that. Another woman that I interviewed, she said, I was doing what the colonizers did when they brought the infected blankets to our communities. Mm-hmm. That's what I was doing over there. I was taking, quote unquote, infected blankets. For them to recognize that they were part of that apparatus really brings on a lot of shame. But at the same time, that acknowledgement allows them to contextualize themselves in that history and use the skill set that they acquired while in the military to be able to use that jargon, that Western way of knowing, in order to speak back to it, in order to say, no, I did my time. I have a say in what all this is about because I was there and because I participated. So they carry that wisdom with them. They can also carry a lot of that shame. And what I will say, in which a lot of us who do any cultural studies understand about the role of women, is that they're the carriers of the knowledge, of the language, of the, you know, the traditions of the culture, passing all that down to our children. And so when you have women are serving overseas or serving in the military, and there is a disjuncture, a trauma that happens, that can be really volatile and really contribute to the continued genocide of our people, because these are strong women that are going and leaving their communities to go find resources to be able to bring them back home, whether that's insurance for their children, whether that's like a steady paycheck for their parents to be able to take care of them. So they go or get an education so that they're able to provide for themselves and their families. But when they come back, they sometimes struggle with the capacity to fulfill their intention of wanting to provide and be of service for their community because of those toxic residues of military service. So their spirits can be wounded and they can really struggle, and that doesn't allow them to transmit those knowledges to subsequent generations where they can become the elders and pass that on because they're stuck. That's part of the understanding that I got, and that was in many ways my story as well. And it was through ceremony that I was able to kind of return to myself from being disassociated from my body for so long. And ceremony is something that I have found really significant and important for the continuation of our people, of Native people. So I'm Chickasaw and Chicana. And what I wanted to do was be able to share that with my sisters, friends, and say, hey, this is a way that you can push away from either addictions of some sort, self-destruction in your life, or suicidal ideations. Come with me. Let's do this other thing. And so, yeah, so there's an annual gathering where women come together and we participate in ceremony, whether it's your first time. In some cases, we're all there to support each other. And this is really been able to witness it and see it now as a rematriation project, bringing back the sacredness of the feminine, of the women. When we talk about land, many people talk about land in a very kind of Western way of like, that's land and we're not land. Ancestors' homes are in that land, that we are the land, you know? And just like there can be disease in the vegetables and there can be destruction, that disease applies to us as well because we're part of the land. We are the land. And so how can we try to push away from that disease of militarization, of war, of destruction, and try to recover. And as I mentioned before to some people who question, why did you join the military? Well, whether it's people are aware of this or not, we're in an invisible draft, socioeconomic invisible draft. When you have Native communities, when you have Latino, Chicano, Black communities who don't have access to education, don't have access to resources, are being actively recruited into the military, while simultaneously other forms of possibilities of scholarships, of education, upward mobility through trade schools is not available to them unless they go through this particular quote unquote rites of passage. It's really disheartening that there's this idea of like volunteer service when in our communities, it's very much three square meals and a place to live.
During the Vietnam War, of course, and World War II, there was the formal draft. And since they ended the formal draft, it's been referred to as the poverty draft. People who are denied access to just basics, many ways, are compelled to join the military, as you said, to secure resources for their families and themselves.
When you start to contextualize it in this way and really start teasing it out, you realize that if it continues this way, without community support, without us taking care of those that return, it really is the continued genocide of our people, because they don't come back the same. There's no on return to build up the human being that was torn down when you joined the military. Yeah. That's also part of, I feel, that needs to be memorialized in some ways, is that young kid that went in with hope of the possibility of, and then you have the return of soldiers who, you know, you have high rates of homelessness, and all of this. There is a reason for it. Many people in our community kind of want to shy away from it, don't want to talk about it. VA is an example. Well, that's there to help you. But the bureaucracy in those places is so astonishing. I myself had a recent experience, and I said to the supervisor of the Ventura VA, I said, this is why soldiers stand at the VA doors and kill themselves, because of the lack of compassion and understanding and the negligence that really happens in places like this. It is a truth that is there. And I'll speak about this for the rest of my life, because I do see the impact to not only those soldiers, but to their children. To the children that have to, in some cases, become the caretakers of them. They don't have a full childhood, don't get to flourish in the ways that they need to. And then they become the recipients of that PTSD. They end up waking up in the middle of the night with flashbacks, or are struggling with alcoholism, or struggling with all those sicknesses that they come home with, those diseases.
And you've described beautifully this intergenerational transmission, the intergenerational trauma that gets passed down one generation to the next. Part of your work is really trying to stop that cycle through the ceremonies. How were you transformed? You're an incredible human being. I imagine you were that before the military and throughout the military. Also, you said you experienced some of what you described. How did you become who you are through the experiences of having served in the U.S. Navy?
Like I had mentioned earlier, my father was an immigrant. He came into this country as a professional boxer. He was recruited in to Los Angeles. I think it was in 1961. He probably suffers from traumatic brain injury, but what I do know is that he ended up suffering from alcoholism. And my mother was the daughter of a World War II Marine who had served in the Pacific. So she also was a recipient of a lot of this violence. Growing up, violence was just part of our life. Like so many other Native Latino communities end up experiencing, because of what they need to do in order to survive, that ends up causing them so much distress and harm. Now that I'm older, I can appreciate and can see how my father's drinking had a lot to do with how he was discriminated against and the humiliations that he had to deal with, and didn't have the resources or the wherewithal to know that he could go out and seek or have the possibility of even that, you know, because time is so limiting. When I was in high school, even before then, I would always be like, but why? Why can't you just let me go live somewhere else? Why do I have to be a part of this? I love my family here in New Mexico because I caretake my family, take care of them as much as I can. And a lot had to do with it because of the pandemic where I had an opportunity. By then I was an empty nester, and I decided to come be with my parents and take care of them during that time period. And I would sit there with them and listen to their stories. My father started working when he was 8 years old. He was put on a bus to go work in Mexico City as an assistant and apprentice to an upholsterer. And they would hammer tacks on the top of his head when he didn't do his job right. So that to me contextualized so much, because as a little boy, he was already getting that violence onto him. So it only further made me have compassion for that little boy that he was, because our life to me was very violent. So much so that I ended up living in a runaway shelter when I was in high school, left as soon as I graduated to major in chemical engineering. Little did I know that I would get pushed out of that very male-dominated field, and there was a lot of predatory behavior around that. I had already experienced witnessing incest within our home, and then seeing brother end up in prison. So that's what I mean. It's just the everydays of things that is very common in our communities. And once I decided to get educated, it became for me a pathway to understanding my family, understand where we came from. I started seeing us from the outside in, for everything personal. But once you get to realize it's not only your family, that this is implicit and that this is the experience of colonization onto your people, intergenerational violence, historical violence, institutional betrayal, all of those things mixed in there. I mean, this is even before knowing about boarding schools, which I very much compared to boot camp. Boarding schools and boot camp are very similar. I thought that the violence would be mitigated by joining the military. Isn't that so funny? I thought, oh, I'll escape the violence by joining the military because they talk about honor, courage, and commitment. That's their ethos of like honesty and goodness and righteousness and honor. And really quick, joining the military, I realized, oh no, this is not that.
But you were drawn by those values that you are so guided by. Just honoring the part of you that were committed those values is really something.
Because I felt those were the things that you needed in order to live a good life, a peaceful life. I was already a very old lady.
Those are values for living a peaceful life, an honorable life.
I find that to be true too. In that moment when I was drawn to that because of that, I thought, well, that and the 3 square meals and a place to live away from a violent home really drew me to that. And then once I was there, it was very much the opposite. I was very outspoken, always had been. Growing up, I had been very outspoken. The threat of imprisonment or any of that didn't really sway me. I was like, what are you going to do, beat me? I know what that's like. I've already been through all of that, you know? So there was not a lot that could be done to me that would threaten me, because I lived a very extreme life, including death threats and all of that. When I was younger, towards the end of my enlistment, there was that possibility of me not coming home with the death threats on the military ship. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to get out of that ship. And so you resign yourself in order to not live in fear, to be like, okay, well, if I die, I'm still going to speak. You make that compromise of like willing to die for what's right. In this case, it was speaking against the violent harassment and assaults that were happening on that military ship to women I was serving with. Your life, it shouldn't deter you from continuing to speak for what is right. During that time, you know, God, I was young. I was so little. I think I was maybe, I want to say I was like 23 years old, you know, when I ended up leaving the military. So I was already in that kind of thinking. And, you know, now we know a lot of activists and a lot of people that are like, okay, and so this might cost my life, but I need to continue speaking. But what is the truth? What is really happening here? You know, when you think about like, what will it take for you to be quiet? it turns out that nothing could quiet me. I was going to continue talking.
Talk about what's the values you're willing to die for. Now you're speaking about what are the values you're willing to live for. Really live every day the values you believe in. And that's how I know you in this day.
I don't think there's any other way. I know to be true for me is that beauty and just joy of truthfulness and of honesty, compassion for each other, and most especially for your elders, your parents, your children. It's something that maybe it had to do with the fact that I wasn't valued and I didn't experience that. That let me know what it feels like to not have that. And I knew that I did not ever want anyone else to feel that I had felt, you know, dismissed, assaulted, all those things that had happened in my past. And so I'm just really grateful that I'm able to come here and to speak with you about all those women, you know, our mothers, our grandmothers. I mean, my grandmother Shimohoke walked the Trail of Tears. The fact that she walked the Trail of Tears gives me so much hope and understanding of the strength, the lineage of powerful women that I come from. Knowing her name, grandmother Shimohoke, and her mother that had, you know, before dislocation through the Trail of Tears, Pansakoyu. And so I was able to find the names of my grandmothers. And I'm like, this is just the incredible women that we need to memorialize, that we need to remember, because it was our ancestors that allowed us to be here. Some of those women might have served in the military. We had warriors all the way around us. We had powerful women all around us who saved our languages, who saved our ceremonies, who saved and took care of and transmitted those knowledges of the songs and the drums and the lodges. And we might just be at an infancy of learning and regaining all of that back. And I'm not going to claim that I know anything except that I know that my grandmother was incredible and that my mother continues to be so strong, even though it's a complicated relationship. That strength, that want for life, and those prayers that they put down for us, to me, is like, that is what needs to
having that same spirit of having ancestry, of walking the Trail of Tears, and ending up transforming not only yourselves, but others. I can't think of better people, experiences, process to remember on this Memorial Day than what you just described. Thank you so much, soon to be Dr. Mondragon.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Or just email us, oldschoolstyle@feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. Thanks for listening.
$10 might seem like a small amount, but when you sign up as a KPFK Sustainer Circle member, that $10 helps pay for daily broadcast of Democracy Now!, the Tom Hartman Program, and all of the news and information you hear on KPFK. You get a lot for your monthly contribution, and we need that gift right now to keep bringing you all of the programs you count on. $10 makes a big impact. We combine it with contributions from your fellow listeners who rely on KPFK as much as you do. Public radio only works with you. This is